Welcome back, Question Madison 2021. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're talking about what I'm reading about. We're going to break down some articles. I have nothing to say, nothing to announce other than if you like this podcast, if you enjoy this podcast, if you learn anything from this podcast, then I encourage you to pass it on to one other individual. The most humbling review that can ever be done, besides for a 5-star review on Apple or iTunes, is passing it on to someone else so they too can question medicine. With that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? You see, there are often studies I read that I think to myself, I wonder why the authors did that. Was it just the publish or perish mentality? Maybe they were thinking, I have to get something out there, so I'm just going to publish something, even if it's completely garbage. Maybe that is what is going on, and maybe that was what's going on in this next article, although I suspect it was something else, and I'll tell you why towards the end. It is a paper in Gut BMJ titled Multicenter Prospective Randomized Study Comparing the Diagnostic Yield of Colon Capsule Endoscopy versus CT Colonography in Screening Population, the TOPAZ Study. If you just looked at the title, Multicenter Prospective Randomized, you would say, oh my goodness, this is going to be a really good study. Well, in this study, the authors of this multicenter prospective randomized study compared the diagnostic yield of colon capsule endoscopy compared to that of CT colonography, all for the average risk adult person doing colon cancer screening. Average risk individual colon cancer screening, which one is better, you say? Well, my first question is why did they use colon capsule with CT colonography? I mean, why not just use the FIT test? Why not use a fecal occult test? Why not use a test that's cheap, easily affordable, easy to use, doesn't really have any complication, is really a pretty good test? Why would you not compare it to a FIT test or a fecal DNA test? It seems kind of like a straw man. Like, you didn't want to go up against the best of the best, so you picked CT colonography. I don't know. To me, it seems like not the best competitor, but if you want to get your study approved and you want to get your study passed, then you have to pick the least best thing that you can do, so that way you might have a positive outcome. So for this study, you either had the colon capsule endoscopy or you had a CT colonography, and then the findings were confirmed by colonoscopy. Everyone got colonoscopy, which is a really good thing because then you're not just working with confirmation bias. They found that the sensitivity and specificity for the colon capsule endoscopy for polyps greater than 6 millimeters was 80% sensitivity compared to only 26% sensitivity for those that were undergoing CT colonography. Now remember, this is a screening test. We want really high sensitivity. So if you're looking for sensitivity here, it does look like the colon capsule endoscopy is maybe the best test that we're gonna have. And if you were looking at polyps greater than 10 millimeters, and these are the ones we really don't wanna miss, the colon capsule was 86% sensitive, and the CT colonography was only 50% sensitive. It does appear that just maybe, if you're comparing these two modalities, then capsule endoscopy might have a way into the guidelines. Although, I would think it's not the best way into the guidelines, so I don't know why they used it. Maybe what we really hear, we should be saying from the study is, CT colonography kind of blows, and we shouldn't be using this anymore. CT colonography probably shouldn't be any guidelines or in any recommendation anymore, because realistically, its sensitivity isn't that good, and we shouldn't use it. That's what I think that this article should say. However, the authors say, this may work for people who refuse colonoscopy. Possible, or you could just use a FIT test, which is true, but this costs so much more than the fit test. It costs so much more than the other really safe, really good option. It costs, I mean, more than pennies, millions on the dollar. The fit test costs pennies on the dollar. So why would we use this test over a fecal occult test of some kind or some way? It's more money, it's more invasive, and realistically, I'm not super convinced that the sensitivity is better than a fit test or a fecal colonoscopy. Why would I go to a capsule endoscopy? It just doesn't make sense. And then I realized why this study was even done. Was it because of Big Pharma? It appears so. When I read the 30-line conflict of interest section, I knew exactly why this trial had to be done. This trial didn't have to be done so that way they could prove how CT colonography is kind of terrible. This trial had to be done so they could prove that there is a potential use for capsule endoscopy. However, that potential use is very small and realistically probably not useful to anyone who actually reads this article or the guidelines or cares about their patient whatsoever. And let's move on to the next article, which is something super scary. It's an illness, it's a disease that 30 to 50% of people don't even know they have. What am I talking about, you ask? It's a paper in JAMA titled Asymptomatic SARS-CoV-2 Infections Among Persons Entering China from April 16th to April 12th, 2020. Whew, you see, China was able to control their COVID-19 outbreak cases. Why was this, you ask? It's because April 1st, 2020, persons or people or visitors entering China via the air, sea, or land all had to get a COVID-19 PCR check at the border. And then, with all this data, they could go back in a retrospective cohort study and look at all the international people that were visiting and all the PCR tests that were done at all the checkpoints across all of China. And what did they find? What did they find among the over 3,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases? Well, they found that among those, 51% of individuals who tested positive for COVID-19, they never developed symptoms through day 13 and were considered to have asymptomatic COVID-19 infection. Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if you don't know you have the disease, you can't stop the disease, you can't prevent the disease, you can't treat the disease. It's part of the reason that we don't do asymptomatic screening for, I don't know, pancreatic cancer. We don't do asymptomatic screening on low-risk or low-yield individuals, people that aren't feeling anything at all or having no other symptoms of carotid stenosis. We don't do things in medicine to healthy people just to find something that we don't can't prevent or can't do anything about. Why, you ask? Why is it that we never do that? Well, we don't do that because it's not healthy. It's not helpful. It's not beneficial. We don't get any bang for the buck. But somehow, some way, in some magical land, we have forgotten about that when it comes to the COVID-19 virus. And we do everything, even when there is really no benefit. And speaking of no benefit, that was in JAMA. This is in Annals of Internal Medicine, a different article. This one is titled, The Proportion of SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 infections that are asymptomatic, a systematic review. The purpose of this study was to estimate the proportion of people infected with COVID-19 who never, not once developed symptoms. And they found the results were that about one-third of the people had no symptoms. And if you test positive and have no symptoms, then about 75% of the time, you will never have symptoms. So let me say that again. A third of the people, when they tested positive, did not have symptoms. Of that one third, three-fourths of the people never had symptoms. They never felt anything. We will never be able to stop what we don't know about. We can never treat what we can never really know is occurring. And we can never ever, and I mean truly never, flatten a curve on something that 33% of the time or 50% of the time, depending on which of these two studies you read or which of these two studies you're interested in, we will never flatten a curve on which 33% to 50% of the individuals have it and they don't even know they have it. It's like vitamin D deficiency. A whole bunch of people got it, but we don't really know what to do about it because we can't treat it. We can't, it's just nothing. It's just out there. We need to come back to some sort of sanity. Let's get the vaccine. Let's do what we should do. But realistically, if we have any hope that we think, oh, we're going to prevent, we're going to flatten the curve, it's going to be great. No, we're not. No, we are not. And with that, let's move on to the next article. The next article is titled Efficacy and Safety of Antidepressants for the Treatment of Back Pain and Osteoarthritis, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This is in the BMJ. And the bottom line here is that you should prescribe antidepressants for depression, not for pain. This was a systematic review and meta-analysis, and it looked to see or investigate the efficacy and safety of antidepressants for back and osteoarthritis pain compared with placebo. Pain and disability were the primary outcomes, and pain and disability scores were converted on a scale of 0 for no pain or 100, the worst pain possible. They looked at a total of 33 trials, and what do you know? Well, for back pain, the SNRIs reduced the back pain by about 5 points on a 100-point scale. The SNRIs reduced sciatica at 2 weeks or less. But then at 3 to 13 weeks, there was no difference over placebo. What about the TCAs? Yes, the tricyclics. They get a great reputation for being able to help pain. And, oh, they did. They helped sciatic pain at 2 weeks or less. But there was no benefit seen at 3 to 13 weeks. And no benefit seen at 3 months to 12 months. You see, if you're going to prescribe medication, you're going to prescribe some sort of antidepressant agent, well, then you should prescribe it for depression, not for the back pain. And with that, let's move on to the last article, which is titled Epidemiology in 3-Year Outcomes of Combined Oral Contraception Associated Distal Deep Vein Thrombosis. This one is maybe one of my favorite articles of the day, which is why we're going to end on it. You see, they took 8,000 women from 2004 to 2006 to be included, and you could not be pregnant or postpartum, and you had to be less than 50 years of age without any cancer. Basically, you couldn't be pregnant at all, and you had to be less than 50 without any cancer. You had to be pretty healthy, relatively speaking. There were 220 women that had either a first distal DVT, a first proximal DVT, or a first pulmonary embolism. Of these 220 women, 48% of them, or 104 of them, were on combined oral contraception pills at time of their VTE. At time of their venous thromboembolism event, less than half were on oral contraception pills, which means, if you're following along at home, that means 53% of the individuals were not on combined oral contraception pills. That means that just maybe, the DVT wasn't the contraception's fault. It just happened to happen. It didn't matter if you were taking the contraception pill or not. In fact, you were more likely to get a DVT if you were in the arm that wasn't taking the combined oral contraception pill. And we like to say, oh, look, they got a DVT. You know what that means? It had to be the combined oral contraception. No, it didn't have to be. It just had to be the fact that people, humans, they get DVTs. They get pulmonary embolisms. It's just what happens. And women also happen to be on combined oral contraceptions. And so we look at it and we say, oh, for sure, there it is, 100% of the time, every time, you know that's what causes it. No. In fact, there was equal likely chance that if they weren't on combined oral contraception, they were also going to get a DVT. It wasn't just the combined oral contraception's fault. Remember, this was 3 years of follow-up, and overall, 28% of the patients developed their VTE less than 12 months after starting the oral contraception. But this article was great because it said, what is the long-term effect of VTE caused by combined oral contraception? Meaning if I have a VTE, I have a venous thromboembolism that seems to be caused or directly related to in the relationship or the timing of which I started the combined oral contraception, what is the long-term effects? And at 3 years of follow-up, all women, yes, all women with combined oral contraception associated distal DVTs were alive, and none had bled during the anticoagulation treatment or experience a DVT or PE recurrence after stopping anticoagulation. At 3 years of follow-up, all women, yes, all women with combined oral contraception-associated pulmonary embolism were alive, and none had bled during the anticoagulation treatment or had experienced a DVT or PE recurrence after stopping anticoagulations. And after 3 years of follow-up, all women with combined oral contraception-associated proximal DVT, so proximal DVTs, there was a recurrence rate of 1.7%, with no deaths and no major bleedings. I think the big take home here is that DVTs and PEs with combined oral contraception are basically just as common in women taking and not taking combined oral contraception, as long as they're not pregnant and not postpartum women less than 50 years old without active cancer. And most importantly, the long-term effects here, the long-term outcomes if you do develop a venous thromboembolism being on combined oral contraception, if you do develop a pulmonary embolism, if you do develop one of these distal DVTs, there is basically really no long-term effects here. Just go ahead and put them on anticoagulation for 3 months, just like the guidelines say, and move along. There was 1.7% recurrence rate in proximal DVTs, but that's incredibly, incredibly small. And remember, we actually don't know what happened to those individuals because they didn't tell us in the paper. We don't know what happened to those individuals, the other individuals, the other 50%. Maybe they had a 1.7 recurrent rate as well, and they had nothing to do with the combined oral contraception. It's just that some people get recurrence rates of DVTs or venous thromboembolisms. It just happens in society. Combined oral contraceptions have gotten a bad rap at times, and they probably shouldn't, because the benefit for them, the benefit for the patient of not becoming pregnant, is probably a lot better than your fear that they may have a venous thromboembolism. And if they do, well, then just go ahead and treat them appropriately and don't worry about the long-term effects. And with that, I will wrap this up before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence. Okay, a quick recap of the studies that I talked about today. If you're going to do a study and you're going to say, look at how good this capsule endoscopy is, you're probably doing it or comparing it to CT colonography because you realize that it's really not that good and you didn't compare it to a fecal occult card because I'm not really sure why until I read the 30-line conflict of interest. And then I realized you were just trying to get your paper published so you could hang it out in the doctor's office and say, look at this, this is what you should be doing. Not because that's actually what's the best thing for patient care. Colon cancer is scary because we don't know that we have it. And speaking of things we don't know we have, well, then you need look no further than JAMA or Annals of Internal Medicine to see that there is a thing called COVID-19. And 30 to 50% of the time, you don't know that you have it. You never know that you have it. You test positive for it, and you never know that you have it. We can never treat. We can never diagnose. We can never do anything beneficial in medicine ever for things that we do not know exist. But speaking of things we can do, we can treat depression and we can treat low back pain, but we should probably avoid trying to treat back pain with antidepressants and thinking that we're going to see any significant benefit, or at least said this systematic review and meta-analysis in the BMJ. And last but not least, women on combined oral contraception do have a risk of having a venous thromboembolism. However, it is really not that much different or really any different than those women not on combined oral contraception, or at least if they're less than 50, not pregnant, without any active cancer or disease. But have no fear, because even if they do develop a clot, even if they do develop a pulmonary embolism, treat them for 3 months. Stop the medication, treat them for 3 months, and then move along, friends, move along. And with that, I will also be moving along, and I'm going to end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.